Okay, so who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? Hands up, those who are afraid. Lots of people are afraid of Virginia Woolf. As you probably know, that's the title of a darkly humorous play by Edward Albee. But it has a particular resonance now, I think, because Virginia Woolf's come in for a lot of criticism in recent years for being a snob whose ultra-privileged lifestyle was dependent on a succession of servants with whom she was constantly at loggerheads, for making anti-Semitic remarks about her Jewish in-laws, and for a number of other things. Now, in this lecture, I'm not going to try to defend Woolf against these accusations. What I'm going to try and do is to consider why we should, nevertheless, want to read To the Lighthouse. I'm going to be looking at Woolf the modernist and Woolf the feminist, and I'm going to be touching on Woolf the pacifist and Woolf the anti-imperialist. But what I want to suggest, first of all, is that it is perhaps a mistake to want Virginia Woolf to be nice. Right? Let's have a look at a photograph of Virginia Woolf. I'm sure you can see it from there. She looks very nice, doesn't she? She looks like an old-fashioned, nice sort of girl, the right kind of Edwardian young woman. But one of the key themes of To the Lighthouse is the danger of niceness, the importance of not being nice. Is that better? Okay. The importance of not being nice. You'll remember the moment in the novel when Lily Briscoe, sitting opposite Charles Tanley at dinner, knows that he is burning, aching to be flattered, to be asked his opinion, to be drawn into the conversation. There he is, you know, made his own way, he feels out of it. It is Lily's task as a young woman to be nice to Charles Tanley, to bring him out, to flatter him. But Lily mutinously decides to resist convention and not to be nice. But she can't resist Mrs. Ramsay's unspoken plea. And I'm going to read a little extract from the novel now. It's towards the end of the window, but just listen. For of course, if Mrs. Ramsay said to her, as in effect she did, "I am drowning, my dear, in seas of fire. Unless you apply some balm to the anguish of this hour and say something nice to that young man, life will run upon the rocks. Indeed, I hear the grating and the growling at this minute. My nerves are taut as fiddle strings. Another touch and they will snap." When Mrs. Ramsay said all this, as the glance in her eyes said it, of course for the 150th time, Lily Briscoe had to renounce the experiment. What happens if one is not nice to that young man there, and be nice? Now, note, first of all, that nothing has actually been said here. Not a word has been spoken. Lily is simply responding to a sort of silent, heartfelt glance from Mrs. Ramsay, and Mrs. Ramsay manages to convey her plea to Lily, and Lily has to succumb and be nice. Now, often in this novel, what is most important is what is not said. What is repressed or sidelined or confined to parentheses, or, as here, what is going on in the mind but not spoken aloud. And the term which is often bandied about, so to speak, to describe Woolf's technique here is that good old term, stream of consciousness. And I'm going to be a bit cautious about that term, because it can suggest something that's sort of involuntary, spontaneous, uncontrolled, sort of gushing out like automatic writing, perhaps. And that, of course, is not at all what Woolf is up to. And to illustrate this, I want to turn to a much quoted extract with which you may already be familiar from Woolf's work, which is often cited as the Modernist Manifesto. It comes from Woolf's essay on character in fiction, essay called Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown, in which Woolf critiques the naturalist school of fiction, influenced by Zola and represented in Britain by H.G. Wells, Arnold Bennett and John Galsworthy. I mean, pretty much forgotten writers now, but writers whose fiction dominated the field at this time. And in their work, Woolf says, in their work, despite all its rigorous and meticulous attention to detail, life itself escapes. In this essay, Woolf describes her alternative to realism. She offers a vision of a different kind of novel, which is extract number one on your handout. Here it is. Look within, and life, it seems, is very far from being like this. Examine for a moment an ordinary mind on an ordinary day. The mind receives a myriad impressions, trivial, fantastic, evanescent, or engraved with the sharpness of steel. From all sides they come, an incessant shower of innumerable atoms, and as they fall, as they shape themselves into the life of Monday or Tuesday, the accent falls differently from of old. The moment of importance came not here but there, so that if a writer were a free man and not a slave, if he could write what he chose, not what he must, if he could base his work upon his own feeling and not upon conviction, there would be no plot, no comedy, no tragedy, no love interest or catastrophe in the accepted style, and perhaps not a single button sewn on, as the Bond Street tailors would have it. Life is not a series of gig lamps symmetrically arranged. Life is a luminous halo, a semi-transparent envelope surrounding us from the beginning of consciousness to the end. Is it not the task of the novelist to convey this varying, this unknown and uncircumscribed spirit, whatever aberration or complexity it may display, with as little mixture of the alien and external as possible? We are not pleading merely for courage and sincerity. We are suggesting that the proper stuff of fiction is a little other than custom would have us believe it. Have you come across that quotation before? Okay, good. It's worth reading with some care alongside To the Lighthouse. So this passage is often read as Woolf's manifesto, not just for modernism in general, but for her own method in her fiction in particular. And in many ways, this passage does, of course, give a good sense of some of the characteristics of Woolf's fiction, the turning away from linear plot-driven narrative towards the fragmentary, the impressionistic, the symbolic, the multiplistic. Perhaps the most famous and most quoted sentence is, life is not a series of gig lamps symmetrically arranged, life is a luminous halo, a semi-transparent envelope surrounding us from the beginning of consciousness to the end. This is often taken as an accurate description of Woolf's own narrative practice. And this bothers me a little bit because it can easily lead to a kind of configuration of Woolf as a kind of mystic, visionary, wispy, mystic, visionary, uninterested in the real world. And I noticed that in that sentence, I put wool instead of Woolf. And in fact, I did that quite a lot of times when I was typing up this lecture. Instead of putting Woolf, I put wool. And I think that was a kind of Freudian slip because one of my sort of aims in this texture is to get away from the idea of woolly wolf, all right? Wolf is not woolly, that's part of my message. So I want to place that quotation alongside another one from Woolf's long essay, A Room of One's Own, with which some of you are familiar, I think, at least in part. And this is, what number is it on the... Number two on the handout, in which Woolf says... Fiction is like a spider's web, attached ever so lightly perhaps, but still attached to life at all four corners. Often the attachment is scarcely perceptible. Shakespeare's plays, for instance, seem to hang there complete by themselves. But when the web is pulled askew, hooked up at the edge, torn in the middle, one remembers that these webs are not spun in midair by incorporeal creatures, but are the work of suffering human beings, and are attached to grossly material things like health and money and the houses we live in. So fiction is not spun in midair by incorporeal creatures, but the work of suffering human beings, attached to grossly material things like health and money and the houses we live in. To the Lighthouse is full of things, food, stockings, boots, pictures, and so on. Not a lot happens. You know, first they don't go to the lighthouse, and then they do go to the lighthouse. But Woolf takes what seems to be small, ordinary, even trivial details of everyday life, the knitting of a stocking, and she makes us see them in an entirely new way. And I think we find a particularly useful account of what Woolf is getting at into the lighthouse if we look at what she had to say about Proust. Wolfe was reading Proust throughout the time when she was writing to the lighthouse, and she said in her diary, this is extract number 3, "The thing about Proust is his combination of the utmost sensibility with the utmost tenacity. He searches out these butterfly shades to the last grain. He is as tough as catgut and as emerescent as a butterfly's bloom. And he will, I suppose, both influence me and make me out of temper with every sentence of my own." Now, what's interesting is that Wolfe uses an almost identical image when she describes the completion of Lilly's painting Into the Lighthouse, and this is extract number 4. "The whole mass of the picture was poised upon that weight. Beautiful and bright it should be on the surface, feathery and evanescent, one colour melting into another like the colour on a butterfly's wing, but beneath the fabric must be clamped together with bolts of iron. It was to be a thing you could ruffle with your breath and a thing you could not dislodge with a team of horses." Now that, I think, is how we should see the narrative of To the Lighthouse, in terms of that combination of evanescence and underlying iron, butterfly's wings held together by the toughness of catgut. In other words, the elusiveness and the tangibility of things. And one of the things which holds the narrative together is the lighthouse itself. Although we should remind ourselves that Wolfe herself was characteristically dismissive of attempts to decipher the symbolism of the lighthouse. This is extract number 5. "I meant nothing by the lighthouse. One has to have a central line down the middle of the book to hold the design together. I saw that all sorts of feelings would accrue to this, but I refused to think them out and trusted that people would make it the deposit for their own emotions, which they have done. One thinking it means one thing, one another. I can't manage symbolism except in this vague, generalised way. Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know, but directly I'm told what a thing is, it becomes hateful to me." So, one has to have a central line down the middle of the book to hold the design together. Now, on reading this, we think, of course, of Lilly putting a line in the centre of her painting, the line which completes the painting, holds the design together, the design of the painting, and the design of the novel. Lily's painting is a kind of microcosm, but then the progress of her painting is a kind of microcosm of what Wolfe is doing in her novel. But what interests me here is that the lighthouse is an image which seems to precisely capture the combination that Wolfe so admired in Proust. The lighthouse is a solid line, something you couldn't dislodge with a team of horses, so to speak. But it's also mobile, evanescent, casting a moving, constantly changing light. So if you think of the moving beam of a lighthouse in the dark, just think of it moving. Think of the way it illuminates a particular scene sharply and then moves on. Wolfe's narrative, in the same sort of way, moves continually from one consciousness to another, casting its light, so to speak, now on Mr. Ramsay, now on Mrs. Ramsay, now Lily, now James, now Charles Tansley, and so on, illuminating the particularities but also the complexities of each consciousness, and showing the connections between them. Now, To the Lighthouse is a very visual narrative. The novel is full of colours. In fact, whole essays have been written about the symbolism of colours into the lighthouse. But it's also full of images of perception, of looking, of watching, of observing, and so on. And it's no accident that in Wolfe's sort of portrait of the artist as a young woman, so to speak, Lily Briscoe is a painter rather than a writer. Wolfe's own sister, Vanessa Bell, was a distinguished painter, and Wolfe often thinks about her writing in visual terms. And I want to look at Wolfe's own visual image of how the narrative works, as she sketched it in her notebook when she started work on To the Lighthouse. So that's extract number 2 on the handout. Two blocks joined by a corridor. Now, I mean, this is literally how the narrative works. Two blocks joined by a corridor. We get two long blocks of narrative, the window and the lighthouse, separated by a thin spine, the short section called Time Passes. And of course, what's controversial is that whereas the two big blocks, the two substantial blocks, focus on the events of a single day, the thin corridor, as I'm sure you've seen, whisks through the events of 7 years, a world war, and the deaths of several of the central characters. Now, even more notoriously, some of the events which in other novels would have been the central focus of the novel take place in parentheses. If you blink, you could miss the death of Mrs. Ramsay. Perhaps you did blink, perhaps you missed the death of Mrs. Ramsay, just in a little sentence. And there's been a lot of discussion of Woolf's use of parentheses and brackets in this novel. Just one example is the death of Andrew Ramsay. I can find it. Put it here somewhere. Yes. In parentheses. A shell exploded. 20 or 30 young men were blown up in France, among them Andrew Ramsay, whose death, mercifully, was instantaneous. And that's it. That's the carnage of the First World War in 1.5 sentences. What I want to take up in the rest of this lecture is the idea of the two blocks, of the doubleness of To the Lighthouse. As Hermione Lee comments in her very useful introduction to the Penguin 20th Century Classics edition, a number of things happen twice in To the Lighthouse. There are two journeys to the lighthouse, one promised, one realised. There are two dinner parties, two paintings, the painting Lily starts and the painting she finishes. And at the conclusion of the novel, as at its opening, we see the same visual image of Mrs. Ramsay at the window. So there's a tremendous symmetry in this novel, despite the apparent or perhaps real fluidity and elasticity of the narrative. There's a real, you know, a very tightly held symmetry there. To the Lighthouse is also a novel full of dualities, past and present, male and female, mother, daughter, Victorian, modern, and so on. And I want to examine some of these dualities at work, so to speak, in the novel, starting with mother, daughter. Now, you'll see, if you start reading around To the Lighthouse, that there are many biographical readings of the novel, and they pretty well all focus on Woolf's depiction of her own parents in the characters of Mr. and Mrs. Ramsay. And justifiably so, you might say, since Woolf herself was quite explicit about the fact that writing this novel was an act of exorcism. She said in her diaries that she was unhealthily obsessed with her parents and that writing of them into the lighthouse was a necessary act. Woolf says in her diary, "I suppose that I did for myself what psychoanalysts do for their patients. I expressed some very longly felt and deeply felt emotion. And in expressing it, I explained it and laid it to rest. When it was written, I ceased to be obsessed with my mother. I no longer hear her voice. I do not see her." But there are different kinds of exorcism at work here. In the case of Woolf's father, it was a question of freeing herself from a suffocating influence, which, she says, had he lived, would have stifled her creativity. As she says in her diary, "His life would have entirely ended mine. What would have happened? No writing, no books, inconceivable." In the case of Woolf's mother, it was a question of putting an end to a long and obsessive process of mourning the exceptionally beautiful and beloved mother who died when Woolf was only a girl. Yet in the relationship between Lily Briscoe and Mrs. Ramsay, Woolf seems to suggest that love is a more difficult and more constraining emotion than fear. It's only when Lily finally comes to terms with her feelings for Mrs. Ramsay and with the loss of Mrs. Ramsay that she's able to complete her painting and become an artist. Now, what we're looking at here is the depiction of something more than a personal, psychological, and emotional bond. To the Lighthouse is a historical novel in the sense that it's about a particular moment in history. Lillian Ramsay and Mrs. Ramsay sort of stand in the novel, so to speak, as representatives of old and new womanhood, Victorian and modern femininity. And at this point, I want to suggest that while you're reading To the Lighthouse, you really need to be reading alongside it some of Woolf's non-fictional writing of the 1920s, particularly the long essay, A Room of One's Own, and not just the little extract in the Lodge anthology. A Room of One's Own, also the later long essay, Three Guineas, in which Woolf argues that there is an inextricable relationship between patriarchy and fascism, and some of the short essays reprinted in the collection Women and Fiction, that's on the handout, especially the essays on women and fiction and professions for women, because she's really working through the same ideas there as she's working through in To the Lighthouse. Now, A Room of One's Own, any of you aren't familiar with it, published a year later than To the Lighthouse, is a pioneering and very readable book which anticipated many of the points which were to be made by feminist critics half a century later, as some of you have seen. In A Room of One's Own, Woolf says, "We think back through our mothers if we are women." And in this essay, Woolf traces the emergence of a female literary tradition. She identifies the material and psychological obstacles which have prevented women from writing. And she examines the relationship between language and gender. Anticipating the arguments of Hélène Cixous many years later, Woolf says, the book has somehow to be adapted to the body. The book has somehow to be adapted to the body. And she argues that the very shape of the sentence, as it has been current from the beginning of the 19th century, is a man's sentence, unsuited for a woman's use. And in her essay on women in fiction, Woolf expands upon this point. She says, yes, this is extract number 7. "It is still true that before a woman can write exactly as she wishes to write, she has many difficulties to face." Rustling of paper. Okay. "It is still true that before a woman can write exactly as she wishes to write, she has many difficulties to face. To begin with, there is the technical difficulty, so simple, apparently, in reality so baffling, that the very form of the sentence does not fit her. It is a sentence made by men. It is too loose, too heavy, too pompous for a woman's use. Yet in a novel which covers so wide a stretch of ground, an ordinary and usual type of sentence has to be found to carry the reader on easily and naturally from one end of the book to the other. And this a woman must make for herself, altering and adapting the current sentence until she writes one that takes the natural shape of her thought without crushing or distorting it." Now, in a review essay on the writer Dorothy Richardson, in this case an essay published before she wrote To the Lighthouse, Woolf expands upon what she means by the feminine sentence. And extract number 8 is taken from that essay. "There is no one word, such as romance or realism, to cover even roughly the works of Miss Dorothy Richardson. Their chief characteristic, if an intermittent student be qualified to speak, is one for which we still seek a name. She has invented, or if she has not invented, developed and applied to her own uses, a sentence which we might call the psychological sentence of the feminine gender. It's of a more elastic fibre than the old, capable of stretching to the extreme, of suspending the frailest particles, of enveloping the vaguest shapes. Other writers of the opposite sex have used sentences of this description and stretched them to the extreme. But there is a difference. Miss Richardson has fashioned her sentence consciously in order that it may descend to the depths and investigate the crannies of Miriam Henderson's consciousness. It is a woman's sentence, but only in the sense that it is used to describe a woman's mind by a writer who is neither proud nor afraid of anything that she may discover in the psychology of her sex." Now, that's quite a complex passage and it bears reading quite carefully, but in your seminars you might like to consider whether these comments can be applied to Woolf's own technique. The question of, you know, the relationship between language and gender has been a controversial and much debated one, so you might like to debate it. But I want to go on to an extract from an essay by Wolfe called Professions for Women, in which Wolfe famously described how she had to kill off the spectre of the angel in the house in order to find her own voice as a writer. This is extract number 9 on the handout. Wolfe has been asked to review a novel by a famous man, and she says this. "I discovered that if I were going to review books, I should need to do battle with a certain phantom. And the phantom was a woman, and when I came to know her better, I called her after the heroine of a famous poem, The Angel in the House. It was she who used to come between me and my paper when I was writing reviews. It was she who bothered me and wasted my time and so tormented me that at last I killed her. You who come of a younger and happier generation may not have heard of her. You may not know what I mean by the angel in the house. I will describe her as shortly as I can. She was intensely sympathetic. She was immensely charming. She was utterly unselfish. She excelled in the difficult arts of family life. She sacrificed herself daily. If there was chicken, she took the leg. If there was a draft, she sat in it. In short, she was so constituted that she never had a mind or a wish of her own, but preferred to sympathise always with the minds and wishes of others. Above all, I need not say it, she was pure. Her purity was supposed to be her chief beauty, her blushes, her great grace. In those days, the last of Queen Victoria, every house had its angel. And when I came to write, I encountered her with the very first words. The shadow of her wings fell on my page. I heard the rustling of her skirts in the room. Directly, that is to say, I took my pen in my hand to review that novel by a famous man. She slipped behind me and whispered, 'My dear, you are a young woman. You are writing about a book that has been written by a man. Be sympathetic, be tender, flatter, deceive, use all the arts and wiles of our sex. Never let anybody guess that you have a mind of your own. Above all, be pure.'" And she made as if to guide my pen. I now record the one act for which I take some credit to myself. I turned upon her and caught her by the throat. I did my best to kill her. My excuse, if I were to be had up in a court of law, would be that I acted in self-defence. Had I not killed her, she would have killed me. She would have plucked the heart out of my writing. So the importance of not being nice. And the alternative to being nice. So Into the Lighthouse, Mrs. Ramsay is clearly the angel, the self-denying wife and mother who puts all her energies into the creation of domestic harmony and the reduction of domestic tension, flattering male egos and soothing away male self-doubt. Lily is the artist who is torn between her love for Mrs. Ramsay, the pressure of her desire to do what Mrs. Ramsay wants her to do, and the need to resist Mrs. Ramsay's allure and the model which Mrs. Ramsay represents. As we saw earlier, Lily can resist Charles Tansley and sort of see through his sneers that women can't paint and women can't write, but she can't resist the more insidious power, the charm of the angel in the house. So what Mrs. Ramsay is inviting Lily to do, and what Mrs. Ramsay herself does in her relationship with Mr. Ramsay, is expounded in a famous passage of A Room of One's Own on the idea of the woman as looking glass. I know some of you will be familiar with this already, but I want to have a look at it, because here Wolfe makes explicit something that is implicit Into the Lighthouse, something that you have to read between the lines, perhaps, to see. She makes explicit the intimate connection between ideologies of gender and the smooth functioning of empire. I'll repeat that because it's important. The intimate connection between ideologies of gender and the smooth functioning of empire. So here it is. And if you haven't come across this before, I have to emphasise that Wolfe's tone here is profoundly and deeply ironic. "Women have served all these centuries as looking glasses, possessing the magic and delicious power of reflecting the figure of man at twice its natural size. Without that power, probably the earth would still be swamp and jungle. The glories of all our wars would be unknown. We should still be scratching the outlines of deer on the remains of mutton bones and bartering flints for sheepskins or whatever simple ornament took our unsophisticated taste. Supermen and fingers of destiny would never have existed. The Tsar and the Kaiser would never have worn crowns or lost them, whatever may be their use in civilized societies. Mirrors are essential to all violent and heroic action. And Wolfe, of course, was a lifelong pacifist. That is why Napoleon and Mussolini both insist so emphatically upon the inferiority of women, for if they were not inferior, they would cease to enlarge. That serves to explain in part the necessity that women so often are to men. And it serves to explain how restless they are and her criticism, how important it is for her to say to them, this book is so impossible, sorry, how impossible it is for her to say to them, this book is bad, this picture is feeble, or whatever it may be, without giving far more pain and rousing far more anger than a man would do who gave the same criticism. For if she begins to tell the truth, the figure in the looking glass shrinks. His fitness for life is diminished. How is he to go on giving judgment, civilizing natives, making laws, writing books, dressing up and speechifying at banquets, unless he can see himself at breakfast and at dinner at least twice the size he really is? Now, the relationship between Mr. and Mrs. Ramsay, in a sense, exemplifies this idea of the bolts of iron beneath the fabric, the idea of two blocks joined by a corridor. It's a highly structured and structural relationship. Mr. Ramsay can only exist, can only function as he does, can only say I, because Mrs. Ramsay is as she is. The two things are completely interdependent. Mrs. Ramsay could not function if Mr. Ramsay was not as he is. As I said, that two, each is dependent on the other. But this isn't just, Wolfe is suggesting here, this isn't just a matter, a personal matter. It's not a matter of men being bossy and women being submissive. That's not really what she's getting at. What Wolfe suggests in the novel, as in the essay, is that the functioning and continuation of the empire, the whole idea of going out and civilizing natives and making laws and all the rest of it, the functioning and continuation of the empire depends on the relationship between the Ramsays being as it is. And the depiction of Mr. and Mrs. Ramsay in the novel fascinatingly anticipates the ways in which feminist literary and cultural critics have more recently distinguished between male and female ways of seeing. You may be familiar with some of the arguments which have been put forward by French feminist theorists about the phallogocentricity of linguistic structures and the gendering of speaking and thinking. Into the Lighthouse, we seem to have the perfect exemplification of these differences. Mr. Ramsay's thought processes are linear, dogmatic, objective, rational, compelled by and obsessed with expressing and pursuing the truth. Mrs. Ramsay, on the other hand, sees truth as less important than feeling. And her thought processes are fragmented, elusive, subjective, emotional, relational. Mr. Ramsay says, we will not go to the lighthouse. Mrs. Ramsay says, we will go to the lighthouse. There is, however, so I mean, that's a kind of exemplification of, you know, Wolfe's kind of fascination with gender and its impact on thought and language within the world in which Mr. and Mrs. Ramsay live. But there is, I think, a certain contradiction or pull, you could say, between Wolfe's feminism and her modernism. Although in her essays she repeatedly emphasises the difference between male and female values and stylistics and so on, she also holds on to a modernist faith in impartiality and transcendence. And I'll come back to that point later on. But just to say now that in A Room of One's Own, she advocates the idea of the androgynous mind as the creative ideal. In extract number 11, Wolfe says, "It is fatal for anyone who writes to think of their sex. It is fatal to be a man or woman pure and simple. One must be woman manly or man womanly. It is fatal for a woman to lay the least stress on any grievance, to plead even with justice any cause, in any way to speak consciously as a woman. Now, Woolf's advocation of androgyny has been fiercely criticised by some feminist critics, but it may be argued, as Makiko Minow-Pinckney does in her book on Woolf, that the concept of androgyny was, for Woolf, a way of mediating between modernism and feminism. Minow-Pinckney suggests that Woolf's concept of androgyny places in question, so to speak, the conventional binary oppositions which constitute conventional notions of gendered identity. She suggests that Woolf is kind of opening up a space beyond the fixed unities of masculine and feminine, a space, rather, of multiplicity, joy, play of heterogeneity, a fertile difference. And I think it would be interesting to think about, you know, does that work, if you're thinking about To the Lighthouse? Is Woolf also opening up, despite her kind of, you know, the way in which she looks at gendered polarities, is she also opening up a space beyond those polarities? But whichever way you choose it, if Mrs. Ramsay is the angel in the house, it's clear that the novel has some difficulty in killing her off. And Suzanne Raitt, in her book On To the Lighthouse, emphasises, very interestingly, I think, the novel's investment in Mrs. Ramsay's beauty. The way in which the narrative continually dwells on Mrs. Ramsay's allure. And she argues that this may work in the novel against the desire to relinquish or to resist what Mrs. Ramsay represents. She says, in spite of its exploration of Lily's ambivalence towards Mrs. Ramsay, the novel still turns on the image of her beauty. It is she for whom the novel yearns, and it is hard as readers to resist her powers of seduction. And Raitt goes on to look at the way in which the narrative continually slides in and out of Mrs. Ramsay's mind. She says, the impression given is one of fluidity, of a multiplicity of possible perspectives and tones, all existing simultaneously and held in suspension by the turns of the narrative. As soon as one train of thought reaches resolution or faces some kind of check, the narrative simply flows easily into another. This produces a peculiar feeling of peace and restlessness. Peculiar feeling of peace and restlessness. Sentences are never actually prevented from continuing, but lines of thought are perpetually taken up, only to be dropped. This means that resolutions are only ever local, and the project of the novel is to find a way of combining its characteristic fluidity with the achievement of finality. In other words, in a sense, how is Woolf going to end this novel? And that, indeed, presented Woolf herself with considerable problems, because what she clearly wanted to do was to maintain the multiplicity of the novel, the way in which it holds dualities in suspension and sort of runs the different threads of the narrative alongside one another. You know, so in a sense, it ought to go on forever. It ought not to stop. And she even thought of ending the novel with one of those famous parentheses. She wrote in her diary, this is extract number 12, at this moment, I'm casting about for an end. The problem is how to bring Lily and Mr. Ramsay together and make a combination of interest at the end. I'm feathering about with various ideas. The last chapter, which I begin tomorrow, is In the Boat. I'd meant to end with R climbing onto the rock. If so, what becomes of Lily and her picture? Should there be a final page about her and Carmichael looking at the picture and summing up Ramsay's character? In that case, I lose the intensity of the moment. If this intervenes between Ramsay and the lighthouse, there's too much chop and change, I think. Could I do it in a parenthesis so that one had the sense of reading the two things at the same time? And I think this is something that kind of constantly impels To the Lighthouse, the idea of reading two things at the same time. For example, Lily says of Lily Briscoe, this is from the novel, For what happened to her, especially staying with the Ramses, was to be made to feel violently two opposite things at the same time. That's what you feel was one. That's what I feel was the other. And then they fought together in her mind as now. So feeling two opposite things at the same time. And this is, you know, we should remember a pivotal moment in the novel when Mrs. Ramsay makes it possible for two of her children to feel two opposite things at the same time. I'm talking about the incident with the boar's skull, where Mrs. Ramsay is faced with a dilemma, because Cam can't go to sleep with the skull in the room, and James screams if she touches it. So what Mrs. Ramsay does, you will remember, is to cover up the skull with her own shawl. And I was going to read that, but perhaps, well, I'll read a little bit of it. So she goes and she takes her shawl off, and her own shawl off, and winds it round the skull, wound it round the skull, round and round. And then she came back to Cam and laid her head almost flat on the pillow beside Cam's and said how lovely it looked now, how the fairies would love it. It was like a bird's nest, and so on. And Cam falls to sleep. Now, she whispered, crossing over to his bed, James must go to sleep too, for, see, she said, the boar's skull was still there. They had not touched it. They had done just what he wanted. It was there quite unhurt. He made sure that the skull was still there under the shawl. So here, in a sense, Mrs. Ramsay works magic. She makes two opposing, competing versions of reality coexist. She makes the skull simultaneously absent and present, skull and not skull. I've been trying to suggest in this lecture that this sort of looking two ways at once is characteristic of the novel's modernism. But I want to suggest now, perhaps paradoxically, that it even applies to the novel's modernism. To the Lighthouse sets up a polarity between modernism and modernity on the one hand and Victorianism on the other. The novel is full of allusions to Victorian values, Victorian literature, to the world of empire, to the poetry of Tennyson and Clough, and so on. And I think here, again, what is implicit into The Lighthouse is made explicit in A Room of One's Own, in which the narrator directly addresses the nostalgia she feels for the poetry of Tennyson and Rossetti, her regret at the loss of lyricism, the mellifluous musicality of the kind of poetry to which, she suggests, the war has put an end. So in other words, there's a sort of mourning for the loss of that pre-war era at the same time as a recognition that clearly it had to go. You had to let it go. And I think that nostalgia is there also into The Lighthouse, and Woolf seems to have recognised this herself. As always, when she completed the novel, she brooded over what her critics might say. I don't feel sure what the stock criticism will be. Sentimental? Victorian? Okay. So there's also, as I suggested earlier, a pull between Woolf's modernism and her feminism. Now, it was a central tenet of high modernism, expressed in different ways by James Joyce, by T.S. Eliot, D.H. Lawrence, among many others, that the best art, the highest art, was impersonal. Impersonality and disinterest were the characteristic of the highest art. Therefore, the work of literature should not be a conduit for the writer's personal emotions, and the artist should not let his or her personal grief or anger or political views show. And Woolf is very clear about this in A Room of One's Own. Some of you will know she comes down very hard on Charlotte Bronte for being angry, for like, giving vent to her anger, and sees it as a distortion of her talent. And as I quoted earlier, Woolf says, it is fatal for a woman to lay the least stress on any grievance, to plead, even with justice, any cause, in any way to speak consciously as a woman. But I've been suggesting that, you know, To the Lighthouse works in double ways, and I think we can find in many ways underneath the surface the emotions, the views which Woolf seeks not to convey on the surface. Frederick Jameson has argued that modernist works are not to be read simply as an attempt to distract us from reality in favour of art. Jameson says, famously, what they do, in other words, what modernist works do, attempt to do, is not to express but rather to manage these fears, to disguise them and to drive them underground. So not to manage these fears, but to disguise them and to drive them underground. In other words, what Jameson is asking us to do, and I think one can say this at any modernist text, is to look at what is repressed as well as what is on the surface of the text. And it seems clear that the writing of To the Lighthouse came out of the need, as I said, to exorcise great personal loss. Now, Wolfe goes to considerable lengths to transform and disguise that loss. To take one small example, the idyllic holiday home of her childhood is moved in the novel from St. Ives in Cornwall, which is where the family went every summer, to the other end of the British Isles, to the Scottish Hebrides. More generally, Mrs. Ramsay is not Wolfe's mother, Lily Briscoe is not Virginia Wolfe. And Wolfe herself described this novel and some of her other earlier work as a new kind of genre in fiction, an elegy. She wrote in her diary, "I am making up To the Lighthouse. The sea is to be heard all through it. I have an idea that I will invent a new name for my books to supplant novel, a new by Virginia Woolf. But what? Elegy?" Now, Woolf's use of the word elegy is, I think, typically double-edged. It means both mourning for what is lost and, I think, also letting go of what needs to be relinquished. Mourning for what is lost, but also letting go what must be relinquished. The novel can be understood as an elegy for Woolf's parents, for her childhood summers spent by the sea in Cornwall, and in a wider sense, if you look closely, as an elegy for the terrible decimation wrought by the First World War, and indeed for the end of the British imperialist ideology, which had made that war inevitable. And I want to end just by mentioning a fascinating essay by Janet Winston on To the Lighthouse, in which she sets out, in the Jamesonian sense, she sets out to uncover the repressed political content, the not said of this novel. And she shows how this novel is full of images of deterioration, of sinking houses, sinking islands, sinking ships. And Winston suggests that what is submerged, so to speak, in Woolf's text is not just the events of World War I, but rather the entire institution of British imperialism, the sinking British Empire, whose political and economic hegemony was sinking into decline. I think that's